Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Thursday, October 13th, 2022. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA.
No, we're
not. And also the ballroom at the Bellagio Hotel. I am in Las Vegas, Nevada for the semi-annual.
Oh, yeah, I don't know.
Semi-annual Mass Torts Conference. Back for the first time in 3 years. On the program today, we will be interviewing plaintiffs' attorneys representing cases that range from forever chemicals that have been dumped by corporations, human trafficking. We'll be talking defamation lawsuits. We'll be talking about possible lawsuits against social media companies and more. Also on the program today, Alex Jones deep in the red after a $1 billion jury award. Possibly the last January 6th hearing will take place today. That after hearing of massive weapons cache at the ready outside the Capitol. Meanwhile, a Trump aide seen on a security camera footage moving boxes of documents. The Durham investigation trial not going very well for Durham. Ryan Vance now in a dead heat in Ohio. NATO agrees to send missile defense weapons to Ukraine. Social Security recipients will be getting a 9% bump as inflation rises 0.4% in September. Lastly, the Parkland shooter jury recommends life sentence for the Parkland shooter. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. I am in Las Vegas. Emma is back in New York. Emma?
Hi.
There she is.
Oh.
No, go to the other one. Go to the front-facing one until we get into the
interview. Okay. Okay, we're figuring that out.
And then now put Emma into that one.
Yep, it's coming.
So, folks, let me just explain. Now, Emma, I've never done this while you've been on the show, have I?
No. I mean, I've heard about it from you, but this is the first time that I'm actually doing this with you. Yes.
Why can't let's put Emma up on the thing? Are you still working on that?
Matt's working on it right now.
Oh, I see. Yeah, okay. I screwed up everything by putting that second camera in. So let me just explain to you what this is. It is all these plaintiffs' attorneys, and they're not just plaintiffs' attorneys. A lot of times, like a lot of civil rights attorneys, will also have a plaintiff's sort of, I guess, aspect of their jobs. In the past, I've interviewed Rosa Parks' attorney. That was, you know, I've been coming here for 10 years now, I guess, pretty close. You know, formerly with Ring of Fire, and I think if you're looking behind me, you can see maybe the images of I'm in the booth that is sort of the Ring of Fire American Lawyer booth. I ended up I was hosting it when I first started 10 years ago, Ring of Fire, with Mike Papantonio and Bobby Kennedy. I've talked about that in the past. Oh, things got a little bit difficult towards the end there, but Mike Papantonio is one of the biggest plaintiffs' attorneys in the country. And he, in fact, litigated the case ultimately that with a massive award against DuPont that the movie, I think it was like Dirty Water or Dark Waters with Mark Ruffalo was.
Yep. Yeah.
And Papantonio, I don't think his character was in there because it covered a different portion of the case. But over the years, I would be interviewing these lawyers, the lawyer that was played by Ruffalo, I think, and others before any of this really came out. And we've interviewed people about Remington rifle, which would fire without anybody pulling the trigger, having killed multiple people over the years, and Remington being aware of it, and never doing a full recall until much later. Folks can see part of that story, I think, at 60 Minutes, but we interviewed a public interest attorney here. And it's a wide range, but they're bringing cases against corporations more often than not. Sometimes they're bringing it against governments, but it's almost exclusively against corporations who have created a product, selling a product that they know or should know is harming people. And the relationship between statutes that get passed, we're going to talk to hopefully someone about these massive, and maybe you've seen ads for it, Camp Lejeune.
I literally saw that yesterday. I was thinking I was going to ask you about it. Yes. And okay, that's amazing.
So that bill, that big vets bill that passed, I don't know, a couple of weeks ago, one of the things that was embedded in that bill was the right of action of citizens to sue because they had gotten cancer because of having been stationed at that base. And so there's a fascinating relationship between government and legislation and what these attorneys do. And so basically what I did yesterday, I'm walking around, I'm getting help from my old producer Scott Milliken at Ring of Fire, who works in Levin Papantonio, or the firm that Mike Papantonio is, and they're like partners with this conference. So a lot of the attorneys we're going to hear from are going to be from that firm. There'll be others. In fact, the first attorney we're going to hear from is the attorney for parents who are suing Alex Jones in Texas in the next case. And just we had planned to interview him anyways, but obviously the big story today is the $1 billion settlement, or not settlement, I should say, award to a bunch of these parents who were subjected to Alex Jones repeatedly claiming that they were crisis actors and that it was fake, nothing ever happened there. And it's really important to understand that there's two things going on here with this. And I think, you know, obviously the lawyer can speak to this, but he's doing the work of the NRA in this instance. He's doing this, he does it obviously to make money, but he's also doing the work of the NRA. This denial of these mass shootings comes out of stoke a fear that the government is coming to take your guns away. I mean, that's what this is. That's what the root of these things are. So there's a political element to this, obviously. And then there's just this element of like, it's defamation, right? I mean, this is not, and people should be clear, he's not paying because he put out misinformation. He's putting out because he defamed these people who were not celebrities, not known, and caused them irreparable harm in their lives.
After a significant irreparable harm had been committed on their lives.
The subject subjected them to harassment, death threats. Many of these parents had to move. There was a parent that I know took their own life in the wake of this and was a subject to Alex Jones's harassment. So just, I mean, it doesn't get more despicable than what he's done. So he deserves every cent that he's going to have to pay these people.
Absolutely. And, you know, we'll talk to the lawyer and find out, like, how does a guy who doesn't have $1 billion pay $1 billion? But here is Alex Jones. He was on his show when the verdict was announced. And what analysts of this case and his first case have been saying is that at one point it seemed like he abandoned a legal strategy when he realized he was just going to lose and sort of switched into a strategy of I'm going to try and just like make the money up on my show.
Yeah.
And then I think when this verdict came down, he realized like there is no amount of vitamins that I'm going to sell that are going to,
you're being kind by even calling them vitamins, Sam.
Well,
supplements,
vitamins.
Brain Force or whatever. Just, which one's Brain Force?
Taking so much Brain Force, I have to pay $1 billion in damages.
So understand, this is the subtext that you, when you're watching him hear the verdict in real time, or I should say the awards in real time, because I think he thought it was going to be much less. And that, like, he could dig himself out of this hole. Let's play that clip.
Damages to plaintiff Erica Lafferty.
Okay, so this is going to take hours and hours to hear about the billions and billions and billions I owe. Let's put up Drudge Report right now for people. $1 billion owed by Alex Jones. I personally don't have $2 million. The company's almost completely out of money. We're in bankruptcy. There's two appeals. It'll take years. There's caps on almost all of this. This is just completely, absolutely made up. And now the Democratic Party run, CNN bought it years ago. Literally, I was told that. Drudge Report is just up there celebrating this. They want to scare everybody away from freedom and scare us away from questioning Uvalde and what really happened there or Parkland or any other event. And guess what? We're not scared and we're not going away and we're not going to stop. And literally, for hundreds of thousands of dollars, I can keep them in court for years. I can appeal this stuff. We can stand up against this travesty, against the billions of dollars they want. It's a joke. So please, go to InfoWarsStore.com and get Vitamin Mineral Fusion. Get X3. Get all the great products.
Everyone.
That are there that keep us on air at InfoWarsStore.com or 888-253-3139. You want somebody to fight? We're going to get attacked for doing it. You want somebody to stand up? It's going to happen. They're going to come after us.
So you got to take every pill
it's okay
I offer.
Because we're here.
All at once.
It's okay that Tim Cook runs death camps because he's gay. Remember that. So these are monsters, a dead system. The things that can demonize me, the head populist, and that'll make you all go away and be scared. But you're not scared. You're going to stand up. Flood us with donations at SaveInfoWars.com. Hundreds of thousands of dollars can beat their millions of Democratic Party money and all their frauds. And get products at InfoWarsStore.com. like Vitamin Mineral Fusion and X3, 50% off, promo code 1776, and that will save you another 10%.
Well, I mean, those supplements, he makes a lot of money off of those. I saw the Washington Post wrote this up, but that he, in 2 years, made $168 million, or $65 million from 2016 to 2018. That's what InfoWars raked in. So it's not... like, he's going to still have to pay a substantial amount of money. Him saying he doesn't have $2 million is hilarious. Yeah. Like, I guarantee you he's bought some gold bricks or put some cash in the backyard so it's not detectable. There's no chance. He's going to have to pay a lot of money still.
Can we also appreciate how he called himself the head populist?
Yes. And it also, you know, I mean, it speaks to his audience that this is all Democrats' money that is funding this these lawsuits, right? Like, I mean, he could have framed it as the one world government people again. There's multiple things he could have framed it as. However, he frames it in the context of the Democratic Party, which is, I think it's worth noting because I think it indicates a change in his audience that has taken place over
the promo
years.
Code is 1776. I mean, that says all you need to know there.
I'm the head patriot. Buy my silver supplements.
Yeah.
We're going to fight, and we're going to fight by you purchasing all sorts of, you have no idea what's in those pills. You have no idea.
If you have diarrhea, that's just a part of the fight.
It's like a donation multiplier, like saying, like, your $1 beats $10 of the Democrats.
Exactly.
If you give it in Bitcoin.
But we are, we're waiting here now. I'm still waiting for the guest to show up, anticipating hopefully Mark Bankston, who is the attorney for the next round. There were three different cases, two in Texas, one in Connecticut. The big thing too we should note about the Connecticut case, there is no cap on tort awards in Connecticut. There is a cap, this is my understanding, in Texas. And so the amount of money in that first case that he'll have to pay is capped, theoretically, or literally. That is not the case in the Connecticut award. So that's a big difference in terms of like the jurisdictions. That's why, if you're the defendant in that instance, like Jones, you want to do it in Texas.
Mm. Yeah.
All right. Let's play the clip of the jury because I'm still waiting here, looking around, and support staff is a little thin around here.
All right. Well.
So let's,
Do you want me to set this up?
Yeah, please.
So here is another clip about the fallout of this Alex Jones trial. This is a part of his live stream where, again, he's trying to monetize this situation to the best of his abilities so that he has the funds to actually pay the up to $1 billion that he was found to have been liable for in terms of the financial damages necessary for the parents that he defamed. And he's just doing full-on Carnival Barker stuff here, shouting and cheering every time the verdict is read for the different sums of millions that he's going to have to be forced to pay here.
To plaintiff Robbie Parker, A, defamation / slander damages, past and future, $60 million.
Yeah.
Emotional distress damages, past and future, $60 million. Total fair, just, and reasonable damages to plaintiff Robert Parker and against Alex Jones and Free Speech Systems and line A and line B, total $120 million.
Yeah.
Controlled by Gerard.
Yeah.
To plaintiff David Wheeler. A, defamation / slander damages, past and future, $25 million. B, emotional distress damages, past and future, $30 million.
Yeah!
Total, fair, just, and reasonable damages to plaintiff David Wheeler and against Alex Jones and Free Speech Systems at line A and line B, $55 million.
Yeah!
Initial...
Never said their name, don't know who they are.
To plaintiff Francine Wheeler. A, defamation / slander damages, past and future, $24 million.
Yeah!
B, emotional distress damages, past and future, $30 million.
Yeah!
Total fair, just, and reasonable damages to plaintiff Francine Wheeler and against Alex Jones and Free Speech Systems, at line A and line B, total $54 million.
Yeah!
Initialed by juror number one.
Woo!
To plaintiff Jacqueline Barden, A, defamation / slander damages, past and future, $10 million. B, emotional distress damages, past and future, $18,800,000.
Good, good.
Total fair, just, and reasonable.
that's one way to deal with it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it the guy's nervous.
That clip is almost 8 minutes, by the way.
Yeah. Right. I mean, cope. Fine, right? Like, He's just trying to make it into some... he's trying to look like the big guy for his audience, as if none of this actually matters. I'm totally not owned here. Don't worry about it.
Well, I mean, and I think part of it is the strategy that he had abandoned the whole legal aspect of this, right?
To avoid discovery. I mean, that was part of it, isn't it?
Well, I don't know. I think he... Well, in this instance...
Yeah.
Yes, in this instance, my understanding is he basically did not contest whether he was guilty or not and went immediately into the award phase. I think he just realized, like, in Texas, if he couldn't win in Texas, he was not going to win in Connecticut. And, you know, this is... basically the Newtown shooting happened more or less, you know, Sandy Hook, you know, well, I don't know how many miles, but it's basically your backyard, right? I mean, it's in Connecticut. And so I think he realized he was going to lose the question as to whether he was liable and go right to how much is it. And, you know, you don't act this way in public, again, mocking the whole thing and the people. Like, I never said their name if you think that you're going to win a trial in Texas. Mm. You're doing that because you have shifted strategies to, I'm just going to try and ride this out for the rest of my life. And I don't know. I mean, hopefully we get the lawyer Mark Bankson, who's representing these families down in Texas. In the
we
Texas
do have another
case.
Clip though that you might enjoy
from
here,
just about a half hour ago. Alex Jones was on Crowder's show, and he has an interesting reason for not worried about the size of the damages.
Interesting. All right, let's see this.
You have the rhinos, the neocons, the rabid left allied together against the populist uprising of nationalist Americans who are peacefully trying to take our country back. So I'm way more concerned about nuclear war. I'm way more concerned about financial collapse. I mean, here's a good point, Stephen. Quite frankly, the way inflation's going, the way it accelerates towards Weimar Republic or Zimbabwe, in 10 years... there's such inflation, $1 billion will be like $1,000.
Yeah.
I mean, at the current rate we're at here, so...
Chase us.
Oh. Hey, I mean, you don't have to... He does not have to worry about that. Hey, it's just numbers on a page, right? And it doesn't mean anything. It could mean $1 if it means $1 billion.
Well, he also raises a good point about inflation, that, you know, for people with loans at fixed rates... that is, inflation is actually pretty good.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why bankers don't like inflation, because it diminishes the value of the loans that they made prior to the inflation kicking in. But yeah, I don't think it's going to work that way.
No.
I don't think it's going to work that way, but if that's what you need to tell yourself, I would say, you know, more power to you. That's great. You'll be able to... hopefully, you know, if you're lucky, inflation will shoot up to 1,000,000%.
Yeah, what would that inflation rate need to be for in 10 years? $1 billion equals $1,000. If anybody mathematically inclined can sort that out for us.
Come on, Jerome Powell. Help me out here, buddy.
I'll be printing some money.
Exactly. But it is also, you know, the rallying around this guy by people on the right, you know, and the fact that he's trying to sort of drape himself in this sort of like nationalist populist movement, like they're all congealing, right? Like it really is. It is fascinating to see sort of like how that is, because I'm you know, this is the same week that Tulsi Gabbard gave up the ghost and wound up exactly where we all anticipated she would be. And remember, we're only like, 6 weeks out from when Glenn Greenwald did his promotional interview with Alex Jones. to promote the documentary about Alex Jones.
Whole media spectacle around that.
Well, I mean, it was, he even said, like, I know people want me to ask you hard questions, but I'm not going to.
Yeah, that'd be boring.
And also, you're very charming and handsome.
It is interesting to see that the way this is developing, and it really, in many respects, you know, Alex Jones is going to get more and more extreme. He is going to focus on developing a deeper relationship with the audience he has now. Right? Like, I mean, he's not looking for growth. He is looking for a deeper relationship. He's sort of like in what the Trump mode is, with, you know, playing the Q theme song at his rallies.
Right.
The idea is that with an immovable 30% of the population, even 30% of the Republican Party, with an immovable chunk like that, you can win, and you can drain them of cash. And that's what Alex Jones is going to attempt to do. And that money is really just going to go towards, like, sort of like making him deal with the fact that he's going to be short of cash. So we're going to hold off on the moment. Just come right back. I'm ready for you now if you want. Okay. So we're trying to locate Mark Bankston. He is the attorney in that Alex Jones case. In the meantime, I want to welcome to the program Kimberly Adams. She is an attorney, and let's switch that camera shot, Matt.
We just did, yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, let's go to the two shot. Okay, great. And let me just put up. Kim, tell us what law firm are you with?
Levin Papatoni
Rafferty. Okay, so you are with Levin Papatoni. Okay, great. And so, tell us about the case that you are working on.
So, in general, human trafficking, representing human trafficking survivors, and we represent them against businesses who have profited or exploited them, whether it's online businesses or pornography industry businesses or hotels or, you know, you name it, but it's traditionally just representing those survivors.
And so, I mean, give me, how do you do this as a class? I mean, explain to me sort of the
Sure. So, most of these are individual cases. We take them and file one by one. There are class components to the cases that we file. So, for instance, if we have a case against Pornhub for exploiting minors on their website, the class part of that would be the injunctive relief to repair, or in part, right, to repair. How do we prevent that from happening? How do you prevent children from accessing your site? How do you prevent children from being disseminated child pornography on your site? So that's kind of the part of the class action that would reach every child that was exploited in that site.
I see. Okay. Can you give me an example of, like, what are the elements you need to prove to get an award, and what's the end goal here?
So I think the first end goal, the reason that, you know, we are moving these cases, is to minimize, if not eradicate, human trafficking, right? And survivor. Some people may think that's a stretch, but when you get into seeing how long knowledge has been available, training has been available, technology has been available to eradicate this aspect, the same technology training that's being used to benefit these companies, I think our goal is to first and foremost make systemic change in those processes. How do we prove those cases? Is demonstrating the vast amount of knowledge that may exist for those businesses. So, for instance, for a hotel, they may know all the telltale signs of trafficking, right? They may know if someone's here every other week, they're a local resident. It's a trafficker getting a key card, handing it off to a female. You've got foot traffic coming in and out in front of the front desk all night long. There's a lot of different signs that we sort of allege and that we believe they have known and have considered in the past decade and just failed to implement. So I think that that's one aspect from the actual grassroots on the ground case. Make that change, get the training implemented that should have been implemented 10 years ago or longer, and just, I guess, raise awareness, right? I think there's a misconception that runaways or prostitution are something that is by choice. And I think making that systemic change as well. So I've kind of touched on three things. But I think it's, first and foremost, we want to see this change. We want to see corporations take responsibility that they've been saying they have been taking for a long time, but not actually taken. And then hopefully we get damages for our clients. I mean, most of our clients just want this not to happen to somebody else.
Give me an example of, I mean, so the corporations, like how big, are we talking like hotel chains, motel chains, I guess, presumably? And then let's also talk about sort of like technology platforms and stuff like that that are. Yeah.
So hotel brands, that's one of the reasons that we have filed suit against the hotel brands. I don't want to mention any names, but the big brands that we all know and have all probably visited from time to time. We think that that change starts from top down, right? Top down accountability. Who controls the data? Who controls the money? Who controls the finances? Who's issuing out these franchising agreements? What information do they have about those hotels before they permit those hotels to continue to run? If they can change the drapes in the room or the cereal on the cereal bar, they certainly can implement training that can help prevent trafficking. So that's where we've started. It doesn't exclude the motel or the hotel owner on the corner, but we really wanted to start with top down.
Interesting. And so let's talk about so hotels is one. I mean, that's the sort of like, I guess, the site where this is taking place. What are other what other aspects of it that will do?
Sure. So we have a case against MindGeek, which is the owner of Pornhub, the top pornography website in the world, right? Millions and billions of dollars in revenue. And so I think from that perspective, technology is capable of identifying who you are, how old you are, whether or not your face is visible. Technology exists, I think, so that you can make those preventative measures if you want to. If we want to stop child pornography, I mean, our children are sort of addicted, abused to technology themselves, and then to have platforms not take any responsibility. I mean, you could search Pornhub right now and have free access to pornography. Our children shouldn't have that access. There should be some measure to.
So wait. So which end of this is? Is it? Is it that there is pornography on the site that is with people who are being trafficked?
Both.
And then it's also you're representing. You're saying that they need to have more protections to keep children from watching.
Right. So the statute, the Human Trafficking Victims Protection Act statute, essentially articulates that if you are under the age of 18, if you're a minor, then you are trafficked because you cannot consent to prostitution. Right.
Okay.
So if a child is being raped, and that rape gets uploaded onto a pornography website and then disseminated to Lord knows who, that's what we want to prevent. So that child essentially may not have been, or may have been, who knows, bought for the traditional way that we would view trafficking, right? You're in a room, you're being trafficked 10 or so, but it may be that it's just one person, but that trafficking occurs because of the age of that child. It is a commercial act because the pornography industry is going to make money off of every view, every download, every upload, and that's what we're trying to come up with.
So in that instance, your client is the girl or the woman who has been raped or is under 18,
yeah.
And so are there dual defendants in that situation? Obviously, there's someone who actually trafficked her, and then there's that secondary sort of exploitation that is involved by the platform that allows it to be uploaded.
I wouldn't refer to them really as secondary. I think that, but for the platform and the openness of those platforms, that is a separate injury, because when you're disseminating child pornography, that child never gets their life back, right? When you have one instance of child rape, which is horrific in and of itself, that child now has to relive that 167,000 times, however times it's been disseminated, downloaded, changed, and they never get that back. So the Victim Protection Act that I'm talking about is a civil suit for money damages based on the benefit that these corporations are realizing because of that initial trauma. So our suit doesn't have anything to do with the initial perpetrator, who hopefully is in jail,
right?
For the most part. It's because they benefit and they knew they were benefiting from that. That's what has to stop, right?
How do you establish, do you need to establish that they knew, or do you need to establish that they could know and just chose not to know?
That they should have known.
Okay.
They should have known.
So how do you establish that? Like, when you go and make that case, what threshold do you need to clear?
So I think, and I'll just use the pornography industry again, but if you have search terms, like we've alleged in our complaint on your site, that uses the term seventh grader, daddy's little girl, some of those kinds of terms, then something should trigger. We might need to check out what this is. If you have people chatting in your system that are looking and using terms that are traditionally associated with child pornography, then you need to shut that down, right? And so I think that the should have known is there. And if you take the time to look at the should have known, you actually will have the actual knowledge, because those children exist under those images.
I see. And that same sort of, dynamic applies to a hotel, insofar as, like, you know, like you're saying to the hotel, you know what your business looks like normally, and then you can also see what, you know, this abnormal or atypical behavior, or maybe it's typical, you know, too typical, but this atypical behavior that would indicate you have a responsibility to make sure that these criminal acts are not happening on your, or you're aiding and abetting, I guess.
That's right. And there are, we have, depending on where you file the lawsuit, criminal aspects and components to the case, or civil components like racketeering, all those kinds of things, aiding and abetting. And then, you know, the middle player here is the technology industry. So you look at Twitter. There's a case against Twitter pending right now where you have 2 7-year-old little boys, or seventh grade little boys, who wrote to Twitter, per the allegations and per what we know, and their parents wrote to Twitter and said, this video of the two of them, who thought they were talking to a young lady, is now being disseminated everywhere, and it shows sexual acts with minors. Any one of our children could fall victim to this, right? So Twitter's written. Twitter does not bring it down. In between the 7 to 10 days...
Twitter doesn't pull it down.
Twitter doesn't pull it down. It gets disseminated another 100,000 times. And these children now are, you know, that's what leads to this suicidal ideation. This is what leads to, you know, bring me out of school. All of these horrifics that those children now can never have repaired. And it could have been at least mitigated had someone responded, and had Twitter monitored a little bit better what was being posted on their site when you have naked children on there. I mean, we can talk all day long about what AI can do. I think we all know that AI is pretty great, right? And if you can use AI to your benefit, you certainly can use it to prevent that. But when your bottom line is how many tweets, how many retweets, how many followers, how many clicks, and that's how you monetize your business, then we've got to figure this out, right?
I mean, what keeps going back in my head was the early days of AOL. And I remember the late Barry Crimmins, a comedian, who went and testified in front of Congress because he had been a victim of abuse as a child. And AOL was making a killing off of this at the time. This is, you know, 25 years ago, and I guess this is still going on in that respect. Let me ask you this in terms of, like, in the instance of Twitter, but I would imagine this is also the case there could be similar things in terms of like search terms on Google or in other, like what are they thinking? Is it just that Twitter and these other platforms don't want to spend the money on being able to effectively monitor their content for this type of stuff? I mean, is it that they're like actively thinking like, we don't want to set a precedent in taking it down? Like, what?
So I think it's a little bit of everything. I think let's hope that they don't have the intent of wanting this to happen. But the fact of the matter is, you can see a tweet that is repeating and gaining significant traction between retweets in a hurry. You can see what those things are going on. I also think that technology essentially thought with the CDA that they had immunity. So why engage in that level of moderation? And I think that's what's going up on appeal. We have three cases up on appeal in the Ninth Circuit. The Google v. Gonzalez case is going up to the U.S. Supreme Court. They just accepted it. And that, while it doesn't touch on every aspect of our cases, it touches on things like algorithms and our algorithms, neutral tools that we all sort of benefit from, or our algorithms, depending on how you develop them, do they go outside of the CDA and more of a development of a bad product? And I think that's kind of what, you know, we're going to see shake out. It has to be.
I'm not familiar with that case.
So Google Gonzalez is a case where someone was searching for ISIS. And as algorithms traditionally do, and this is a case that is also starting to generate some traction here from a adolescent addiction, is those algorithms, as you look at them, Google may, and in this case, led those viewers to other kind of more terrorist-type, ISIS-type groups, right? And it led to, at some point, this uprising where I think 120 some odd people were killed. And so the parents brought a claim against Google to say, you connected all of these dots for them without doing much of anything other than, without the user doing much of anything other than the initial search. You sort of incited this violence. And so that's where that case is whether or not those algorithms, there's a lot more facts to the case, and it's 150 some odd pages long, but you know, essentially it's how do you slice and dice what tools are neutral as a publisher traditionally as to what the CDA was meant to protect, and how do you determine what is harmful, I guess, and
right,
should not be covered by the CDA.
And I imagine, again, with the algorithm there, much of this is also about just trying to optimize profits, right? I mean, theoretically, you could replace the algorithms largely, or you could monitor them much better if you hired, 100,000 people, 50,000 people, 10,000 people, 1,000. I mean, I don't know how many.
Well, yeah.
But, and this is just, they're willing to have this sort of, I guess, leaky system because their job number one with all these algorithms is just driving.
And you look at, you take and examine a couple of cases that are up on appeal in the Ninth Circuit. One of those is against Snapchat. Snapchat has products, right? Part of one of their products, for instance, was the speed app. And so you have children that are trying, that think they're going to be rewarded by hitting a certain speed in their car. And children were dying because of that. So that case was able to continue as an exception to the CDA because it was argued.
And the CDA, just to let people know what the CDA is.
The Communications Decency Act.
And this is Section 230.
Correct.
Which provides, essentially says, the publisher, they're not publishers, they are platforms.
Right.
And therefore, whatever is uploaded is not their responsibility. And so, as of now, anything you need to argue that this falls outside of that of the umbrella of the CDA of Section 230, and how do you do that? Like,
I think there's a lot of ways. One, I think the CDA obviously is dated, right? 1995, you had that one case that came up, and the Stratton case, and so I think that's dated. The way that you argue it now, some of the causes of action, like the aiding and abetting, those sorts of things, but also products, if you're making a bad product. I also think if you're developing the content that's on your site. So if one of your defendants is making whatever actions that they're doing makes that content itself illegal or contributes to it being illegal, I think those are ways that are being examined or can be examined for that.
Interesting. So what is, and so there's no one big case necessarily that you're working on now, is there, or is there, or is this like a rolling, you're just getting one individual after another, or?
Both. So we have a hotel case that's moving. I think that's probably taken the advance in Ohio. It's the MA case. We have a case against MindGeek, the pornography industry. We have a case against Craigslist that's pending in the Ninth Circuit. And so I think tangentially we're sort of committed to all of these cases where this lingering question of how broad should the CBA be. Not to kind of belabor this, but you know, the CBA has written in it exceptions. Trafficking is one of those, right? So right now the big issue that's up on appeal is whether or not that has to be intentional. You have to demonstrate sort of we intended for this. We have actual knowledge that Jane Doe, I'm looking at her ad, I know that she's a victim, and I know that I'm willing to publish that, or that I should have known
right.
that she was being abused, trafficked, exploited. And they could have certainly known that, right? So I think that's kind of the big questions that are lingering. There's a lot of them. There's thousands of pages of briefing, but we've got three really big cases in the Ninth Circuit out in California, and then that Google case up at the U.S. Supreme Court that may help parse out some of these issues.
I see. And then the hope is after that, like, you're going to have, it's going to change the behavior of these other companies. You're going to see what those.
We sure hope so. Yeah.
I mean, these other tech companies, they're following these cases too, right? I mean,
they are. You've already seen some changes. So OnlyFans, for instance, with Facebook is sort of at least starting, I think, the process of visually verifying ages, not letting pornography on their sites, YouTube, you know, sort of blocking that altogether. So I think from the tech side, you're seeing some changes. I think you're also starting to see changes in the hotels and their trainings. You hear it in the airport, you hear some of those things. With our hotel case, knowing whether or not you can hold accountable the brand for what happened at the property is what's going to be, you know, is what our trial is about. And in addition to all of the, you know, sub-brands and hotel brands that are in that chain, ultimately, again, we're going after the top guys. So we've got a lot of work to do, and I think by mid-next year, hopefully we'll have some decisions and know which way we're going to go.
Kimberly Adams with 11 Papantonio Rafferty Firm, thanks so much. I really appreciate
it. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
All right, folks. So I have a... here we go.
Hello.
Hi. So I have some unfortunate news in terms of our first guest. They're ill.
Oh, no.
A lot of that going around these days.
Yes. There is a suspicion that maybe that's what it is. We'll see. Maybe we might be able to do something from their hotel room.
Via Zoom?
Yeah, and if not, maybe next week we'll be able to do that when I'm out of, not in Vegas, but I am not going to be meeting with that person. I got to say, it is, I mean, I think there was maybe 10 of us on the plane wearing a mask, which was, I thought, sort of nuts. And there are
to Vegas, I'd be kind of impressed. Like, that's a decent number.
Yeah, right.
It was a big plane.
Oh, okay.
It was like a 757. I have my mask. I'll wear it like when I get into the elevator. There is a sense here that the rooms are so big that you're not in an enclosed space. But I don't even know if I've seen anybody wearing a mask. And there's a lot of people here.
And you'd think a tort conference that might be a bit more sensitive to that sort of thing.
I guess so, but also, yeah. You know, it just sees...
You could have been on the Yeah. You could have been on that plane where, did you remember that story where you still had to test to leave the country and test negative, and those college students put Vaseline up their nose to pass the test, and they were all maskless partying in the plane?
Oh,
and they
God.
Got, jeez. Yeah. So, oh,
yeah, okay, great. I've got a next guest here. Come on in. All right, we can go to that two shot now. Joining me is Chelsea Green. You're also from Levin Papantonio Wrestling.
Correct.
Yeah, I think we're doing all those folks today. Welcome to the show, Chelsea. Tell me what you're working on. PFAS case, right? Okay. Will you let people know what are PFAS?
Yes, absolutely. So this herbal chemical, PFAS, actually encompasses now over thousands of chemicals, toxic chemicals that were dispersed into the environment by firefighting foam.
By firefighting foam. Okay.
Right.
Now, what does PFAS stand for? Is it, we call those forever chemicals, right?
Yes. So PFAS encompasses PFOA, PFOS, and actually tons of other chemicals that come from this AFFF, which is what they call firefighting foam. And it has been dispersed over the country into water systems that have caused issues for people who consume these products.
Now, okay, so you got to help me out here with the PFA. Like, I don't know what that is.
Yeah, the pure chemical substances.
Okay, and what was C8 one of the first ones that was litigated?
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely. So the PFAS litigation actually stems from C8.
Okay. So let's just back up. Will you just tell us the sort of the broad strokes of that case? I mean, over the years, I've interviewed different people involved in that case. And, of course, Mike Papantonio was the lead litigator in the final case that sort of ended that like almost 20-year saga, 25-year saga.
Absolutely.
So okay, yeah.
Just big companies like 3M and DuPont knew as early as the 1970s. Even before that, these chemicals were polluting the environment and causing issues for livestock, for human health, and they did nothing to help with this. They didn't let people know until way late in the 90s that this was an issue for them. So that litigation...
And we should say that C8, like my understanding was, the only way you get rid of that... the only way you get rid of that is by burning it, because you cannot. It doesn't have a half life.
No. So one of the adverse effects of PFAS is that it is a forever chemical. It will live in your system literally forever.
And it doesn't. It doesn't break down.
No.
Anyway. Okay.
It's biopersistent. It accumulates in your system, and there's no way to break it down. And that's what we're working on. That's why we're having this litigation now, to at least try and get a system to clean up the water.
Right, okay. And so, and yours is specifically about this foam that is used, it's firefighting foam.
Correct.
How often is this stuff used? Because I know that they'll use it in specific types of fires, but I mean, how often is it used?
So this AFFF product has been used in training exercises. It's used by was used by the military and by your firefighters. So it was used on multiple different levels, which resulted in the contamination.
I see. All water? Like, is it everywhere?
Pretty much. At this point now, we have a number of districts that have found contamination in the water. And in those that we haven't found, it's because they have not necessarily tested for those chemicals.
I see. And so who is it that you're suing? Are you suing
the company. So we want to make sure those that are responsible for dispersing this toxic chemical into the environment right now to come. So right now we're going to go after those manufacturers, those sellers, the people who made this happen. And you are causing significant human health effects.
And who are your clients? Like, do you have, like, how do you, like, how do you establish who the clients are? I mean, if this stuff is everywhere, essentially, and is in, are there specific concentrations or what?
Yes. So the EPA has issued a new, actually, concentration level of 0.0004 parts per trillion now. But we are discovering that municipalities and specifically certain water districts have exceeded that a ton. And so we want to target those areas who have significant amount of contamination, but we're also looking all over the country because there's different sources of contamination. While we're looking at just the water, there's also landfills, and we want to make sure these this product is disposed of correctly so that it doesn't result in contamination of your environment.
I see. Okay. And so and you'll bring it to the corporations that are producing it, or?
Correct. So the good thing about this is that back in the early 2000s, the companies were forced to kind of dispose of these stuff. So they are no longer allowed to use these chemicals anymore. But the problem is that they're still in the environment from the early loss.
I see. All right. Well, it's a fascinating story. I guess it's going to be ongoing for years. How long will it take to resolve this?
So litigation is still ongoing. We have been litigating the case now for about 3 years. And of course, COVID was in the midst of that. But we are close to having our bellwether trials set in mid next year for the first set. And then we'll go on to hopefully get the answers we need for our personal injury.
Okay, when you say bellwether trials, what do you mean by that?
So the bellwether process is going to be our core cases that will go first. Because we have a number of clients in the MDL, we want to make sure that we concentrate on those that we can litigate first, and they kind of set the standard for those to come back, those to follow.
Okay, and MDL means?
Multi-district litigation.
Okay, and so you pick your best cases, and that sets the standard, essentially. And from that, damages, concepts, I guess, that need to be proved are established, and then they're applied to other trials, and maybe at one point, once it's established, like, this is the way it's going, guys, your defendant will go, okay, let's just settle.
Correct. You hit the nail on the head with that. Explain exactly how the process works. Once we get those standards established, it helps both sides, plaintiffs and defense, get this litigation solved.
Okay, great. Chelsea Green, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. Okay, folks. I know we're having a little bit of audio issues. Not quite sure how to resolve that or where it came from. Was the first guest okay?
Yeah. It's just that I don't know if there's something with the background noise that it was just canceling out. I'm not sure.
Are you ready?
Okay. Yes. All right. So we have one more attorney here. Let's see.
Can you swap the mic, Sam? Maybe you use that one and have the guest use the other
one? Okay, we'll try that. We'll see how that works. Bear with me 1 second. We're just going to...
We'll just go to a little quick break, Sam, and then we'll come back
okay.
when you're ready.
Okay. We'll be right back.
defendant.
All right, folks, we're back. Hopefully the sound is a little bit better. We just hit the wrong time where a bunch of people just came in here. Joining me now is Tammy Apollo. She is also an attorney at Levin Papantonio Rafferty. And this suit I'm really interested in because I have a teenage daughter. I have a younger son. Just lay it out for me, like, who it is you're suing and on what basis? Who are your clients?
Absolutely. Thanks, Sam. This is really a heartfelt litigation. Everyone that I speak with has very strong feelings just because it affects everyone that has a family. These young children are very vulnerable, and we're just seeing what negative impact their continuous exposure to social media is having on them and on their development. So this litigation is against social media companies, primarily the Meta defendants, which is Facebook and Instagram. However, because there is a lot of crossover and multi-use of various social media platforms, we do envision that there will be other defendants that participate in the litigation as well, such as TikTok, Snapchat, YouTube perhaps. So I do see, envision that it will expand beyond Meta, but given voluminous market share Meta takes of social media use, especially Instagram, I definitely do see them as one of the key defendants.
Okay, so let's talk about, like, what age are we talking about? Like, who are your plaintiffs?
So the plaintiffs are adolescents. So one of the criteria is that you have to start using social media as a minor. So it affects, you know, children anywhere from age, I've seen as young as 7, 8, and 9, all the way up through 18 years old. And
what characteristics do they have that makes them plaintiffs?
Yeah, so basically what makes, these young vulnerable children plaintiffs is the fact that they become addicted to social media use. And what that means is that there is a continuous use of social media for at least 3 hours a day for an extended period of time. Eventually, the way the product is designed is going to cause reliance, and it's going to cause the children to rely and to come back and continue to use social media. And that is what we're looking for, are children that have a lot of ongoing exposure to social media.
That feels like almost all children.
Yes. Yeah. In this day and age, it is. Everyone is connected to social media, and there's bad stigma if you don't have social media. It's a way of communication. It's a way of sharing information, connecting with friends and family, displaying your creativity. So there is absolutely value in it, and a lot of the youth does rely on it. But the issue is that we're seeing, based on how the product is designed, these social media platforms are designed, we're seeing this negative impact in terms of the signature injuries that are manifesting as a result of the addiction. So the addiction itself is not the injury.
Okay.
It's the stepping stone to the injury. And what we are seeing based on the design defect is that there's a continuous distribution of ongoing content to minors, and the content with time continues to get more sensational or stimulative to continue to
enhance engagement, right?
Enhance engagement, exactly. And eventually, what you see is exposure to a very troubling, harmful content, very negative content that often leads to kind of a downward spiral of eating disorders, of self-harm, of suicide. But all of this is the manifestation of the addiction to the platform. And the platform is specifically designed in a way to foster that addiction.
I see. So your clients are not... they are all addicted to social media, but not. But that's not all that they are. Their addiction has led to negative outcomes, injuries, including suicide, including eating disorders, including any other.
Anxiety,
depression.
And usually anxiety and depression corresponds with one of the signature injuries. So the self-harm, the suicidal thoughts, suicidal ideation, and then, you know, the eating disorders, body dysmorphia, you know, never being adequate enough. Because, you know, what you see on social media, you know, adolescents, you know, can't really distinguish, you know, is it real or is it fake?
Right.
You know?
So what do you have to prove? What are the elements that you need to establish to win the case? You can prove that they have injuries. You can prove that they're addicted. Those are fairly self-evident. What do you have to do in terms of, like, both causal relative to addiction and then causal relative to the injuries?
Yes. So there's a lot of internal documents already that we have looked at that are just...
These are meta
internal documents, where they recognize that their platforms are designed with these addictive features, and they do this for profitability, because the key component for Meta is that they want to increase users' use of their platform. So the longer time you spend using their platform, the more profit they get from advertising. So they know that within their internal documents. But then you have to look at the science. You know, you have to look at causation, and you need to look at specific causation, and what is the connection. And there is a lot of science currently, and more that is developing studies that are showing that there is a causal effect between social media use and self-harm, suicidal thoughts, as well as social media use and body dysmorphia and anorexia. And that is why we are specifically focusing on those two different types of injury categories.
I see. Because the science is there to establish...
To support.
The relationship. And so... you're essentially saying to Meta, or to the court, Meta's making their product more addictive, and they know or should know that some percentage of those addicts they're creating are going to end up injured because of that addiction. Is that basically the case as it's laid out?
That is definitely correct. And you'll see that they have this information disclosed in their own internal studies and documents. I mean, they are tracking.
Now, how do you get a hold of those documents? Is this part of the discovery process already?
Well, there was a whistleblower that spoke before Congress in October of last year, and Frances Hogan. And she, as while she was working at Facebook, took a lot of screenshots of all of this that we're discussing, that, you know, documents that support, you know, this cause and this litigation. And she was a whistleblower. She came out and publicly disclosed these documents and showed just how culpable Meta is. They know this, and they continue to do it.
So they have, I'm surprised by this, but I'm also not surprised by this. They have documents that basically say, we're addicting people. This is how we're doing it. Presumably, it's do it more.
Do it more for profit. And there's obvious, very easy safeguards that they could put in place for minors and for adolescents to prevent this from happening, but they chose not to do so.
Let's talk about that. Like, I mean, is it enough for them to say, because I think that you're not allowed to have an Instagram account unless you're 13, right?
That's
true. But there's no...
They don't do anything to monitor or police that. There's no, and essentially, by law, you are not allowed to be on social media if you're under 13. And none of these social media platforms have any sort of age verification or identity verification safeguards in place.
Why wouldn't the parent, let's say, be responsible for that?
Well, so, you know, that is a question that's been raised frequently, you know, the parents' involvement. And, you know, we've talked about this and we've talked to parents, and really what social media is just, it's a part of life. You cannot take it away from your child. So you can give them all this, you know, advice on how to use it safely as a parent, but there isn't anything that's incorporated into the programs that facilitate that in terms of parental controls or content blocking. So what you see is you have a 13-year-old girl on Facebook, and she's being suggested to males that are over 40 years old to become friends. And that shouldn't be happening. What would a 13-year-old and 40-year-old stranger have anything in common? And why is their Meta's algorithm connecting and facilitating these types of relationships? So while the parent does their best to, you know, make sure
that... I mean, couldn't the parent, though, like, say... I mean, and I'm saying this as a parent. I mean, I know the reason why I couldn't do it. Because my daughter, like, it was the only way... Like, she's connect with her friends.
Right.
I mean, but theoretically, I guess I could have called up all of these kids' parents and said, like, don't do this because my daughter's being ostracized for not having this social media. And are there things that are analogous in terms of this dynamic? Like, there are things that I know that corporations, just because you put up a disclaimer doesn't mean that you're actually free of liability, right? That's not the case, right? I mean, there are other instances in law where it doesn't matter that you say we're not liable for if you slip and fall on this,
right?
When in fact they're liable for it. That's not enough. So, like, just saying this is age restricted in and of itself is not necessarily a bar to any action, because they have a responsibility on some level. It increases their culpability, doesn't it? I mean,
right.
If they're aware that it's bad for kids under the age of 13, let's just say, and they're not doing anything about it, does that, like, increase their liability on some level?
Yeah,
I mean, if I put up a sign that says, this sidewalk of mine is incredibly, in front of my business, is incredibly slippery, so be careful. And I don't do anything to make it less slippery. That's on me, right, as a business owner.
That is absolutely correct. And so while there is a statement that, you know, you have to be 13 years or older to be able to use the social media platforms, first, as you mentioned, they don't do anything to make sure that that is actually being abided by. And second, they specifically continue to make their product enticing to people or children the age of 11, 12, 13, because they want to start grooming them and getting them, you know, hooked on the platform so that they continue to use it and use it. So they're actually doing the opposite. Instead of, you know, abiding by what the law says under 13, you shouldn't use the social media platform. What they're doing is they're creating it to become even much more enticing to lure them into wanting to use it.
Is there this concept of this type of liability? I'm curious, and this may be far afield, but let's say I have a massive podcast. Let's for a moment pretend this is a little bit bigger of a podcast than it is, I'm telling people that you know, you can take sugar water to cure COVID. Let's just say hypothetically, and does the corporation and and you come along and your family member dies because the only thing they would take is sugar water for COVID, can that corporation, under this, the sort of the theory you're pursuing here, that published this, and, you know, if I say this, if I stand in this room and I say it to a bunch of people, that's very different than if I'm a corporation broadcasting it to millions of people, because statistically speaking, if I say it in this room, maybe nobody's going to listen to me. But if I broadcast it to millions of people, there may be, I don't know, 10, 100, 1,000 people who listen to me, maybe 10,000. And if they die, like under the theory that you're talking about here, is there a similar culpability on these corporations? Because I know that we're getting into like the CDA and Section 230 and stuff like that. But in that, I would assume that's also sort of like a Facebook and Instagram defense. Like, they're not putting the material there. They're just developing the process in which to deliver it. Is there an analogy there?
No, absolutely. So the CDA 230 is definitely going to be a hurdle in this litigation because, you know, with any type of case that stems with content that is being created, not by the actual platform, but by users, the social media companies are able to shield themselves with the CDA 230, and it's like a complete immunity blanket. So we're really trying to fight because we think that the interpretation of CDA 230 does not extend to the type of action that Meta is taking. Because you, you know, the scenario that you explained, you are speaking, and you say sugar water is going to cure COVID and a lot of people die. That is your content, and you are broadcasting that. But there isn't anyone, like a social media company, that is pushing that misinformation out based on, you know, what you look at social media. They see, oh, you're interested in COVID. Oh, right. You're interested in cures.
Right.
They manipulate the system based on their addictive desires. So that's, we're hoping that the product liability aspect is going to take a little different view. The court will take a different view on the CDA 230 immunity because of the product liability, because of the features that are in place. They're not neutral, that are created by the social media platforms that foster the distribution of this content.
I mean, this is really sort of the fascinating part, because 230 presumably is based upon the notion that the platform, not the publisher, the platform is content agnostic, and that they, you know, they're not responsible for the content. And presumably, like, part of, for them to be content agnostic, however, how can they both be content agnostic and be aware enough of the content that they build an algorithm around that puts that, I mean, to use a, like a newspaper metaphor, right? It's the upper right-hand corner is where it gets all the views. They're putting it in the upper right-hand corner. How can they be content agnostic if they know enough that this is what goes up in the right-hand corner, right? I mean, that's what their algorithm ultimately does, is it places it in a position that will get more prominence. Just like a newspaper, right-hand corner. That's where people start. I mean, I don't know if people read newspapers anymore, but that's what newspapers used to do.
Yeah, and it goes even beyond that. You know, it's not just a news feed. They're creating content themselves in the sense that they're providing various filters to use to, you know, amplify whatever content you're putting on. They're providing you features to manipulate your content, you know, to make it more enticing.
So they're giving you tools too. So it's not like completely neutral. So that is kind of, I find that it's distinguishable between just a mere publisher. And then, you know, I feel like this is one step beyond that, that you're actually contributing to the production of the content itself in some instances, not in all, but in some.
Are you taking, are these cases, do they go, are they federal cases or are they state cases?
So they'll be both. We actually, just on September 29th, there's a petition for consolidation into an MDL, and that was granted last week. So we are going to have federal cases consolidated in the Northern District of California, and then there is going to be a congruent state court action that I believe may happen or will be a JCCP in California.
What, I'm JCCP?
JCCP is a state, so the MDL is the federal coordination of the cases, and the JCCP is for state court.
I see.
So you'll have a state court venue, and then you'll have a federal venue as well.
And just to be clear for people, when we're talking about a JCCP or an MDL, that is, you may have cases in 50 states around the country, but you, as the plaintiff, the lead plaintiff attorney, or maybe a committee, decide we're going to take it to this circuit on the federal level and to this state on for the JCCP because. I mean, is that right?
Well, very close. So actually, we argued before the JPML panel, which is the panel of judges, and they make the decision whether the case is a case that would benefit and meets the criteria of being consolidated into the MDL, and then they decide which court, which jurisdiction district to send it to, and which judge to assign it to.
And that's a big deal, right? I mean, what judge you end up with?
Exactly.
And so what's the status of this case?
So the status, there is, I think, about 86 cases that have been filed to date. The MDL was just formed last week. So we're really kind of at the infancy. We're going to have our first hearing, pretrial conference with the judge the first week of November. So, and that's really where things are going to start picking up and really moving forward in terms of how, you know, the structure of litigation is going to go forward.
And is there going to be more media about this? I mean, I imagine there's a lot of potential plaintiffs out there.
Yeah, more media.
Well, more media, and also, like, I mean, like, do you anticipate this getting a lot more attention? Because
I think it's such a noteworthy topic, and it affects so many people in the community that I think it's going to get attention because people are going to want to know, you know, what's happening and what, you know, what, how this litigation, you know, pans out, because it ultimately can make a lot of positive changes into how social media, if the litigation is successful, will have, you know, changes into how social media, you know, works, especially for minors.
And would these changes be both inhibiting, limiting what people at a certain age, identifying the age, limiting what they can see, and also on the algorithm side, I mean, I guess maybe that's the same thing on some level, right? It's just having a more specific algorithm based upon where these people are situated age-wise. And I should say, like, you know, just based upon my experience with my daughter trying to get a PayPal account, because she's selling stuff on Depop, she can't do that. She can't. Like, you know, it's pop. She put in her social security number and they just go like, sorry, we're not giving it to you. There are mechanisms in which to do this, in other words, right?
Exactly.
I mean, like, they could, you gotta be 16, have a license or certification maybe of someone else's license that is certifying your age or something like that, right? I mean, there's gotta be mechanisms.
There are definitely mechanisms there that could be easily implemented.
Well, it's a fascinating case. Emmy Paulos of Levin Papantonio Rafferty. Thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
So folks, and of course, as you can see now, people are leaving. They're flashing the light, telling people to go back to into the conferences. And of course, now as our guests have left, things will get much quieter. And that's the way that's gonna go. Hold on, Matt. I'm gonna try and check 1, 2. Is that better?
Yeah, you sound good.
Okay. Yeah, so sorry about that, folks. I know it's always a challenge here to get good sounds. Thank you. And of course, we also lost our first guest.
Hi.
Oh, sorry. Whoa.
It's for a ride.
Oh, wait a second. There we go. Okay. We lost our first guest. Apparently, he is not well at all, and so we will work on that tomorrow. Not 100% sure the guests we have. I'm still sort of efforting different guests, and so we will head into the fun half, and we'll do some clips.
Great.
Fun.
Yeah, it's really loud. And
you might want to just unplug that other mic.
I turned off the other mic already. This is just my mic.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah, it's in past years, like this thing has grown over the course of the past 10 years. And, you know, I was wondering maybe I should get a different mic, like a more cardioid mic. But it would have been more isolated in some respects. So.
All right, well, it's a little hard to hear you right now, generally. So
it is?
We should just
Let's head to the fun half, and then we'll figure it out.
Cool.
Okay, great.
Oh, there's no Left Reckoning tonight because we're still banned, but This Is Revolution. David and I will be on This Is Revolution's YouTube show tonight, so check that out.
Actual horse blank, but what's happening to Left Reckoning.
Yeah, although maybe there might be some good developments coming up, so watch his space, but yeah.
Ooh, Rumble.
Exactly. Cantor Fitzgerald Acquisition Corp. 6 has made us a good offer.
quickly, today on ESPN, we're going to be Bradley and I are in a dead heat for our NFL picks this year. We're going to be determining what the punishment / prize will be for when we win, and we'll be picking the game for the weekend, plus Stanley Cup odds. I think I'm going to actually ruin my whole life and pick the Rangers to win the Stanley Cup based on the odds that I'm seeing. We'll see. That might be the best value. Tune in to ESPN at 4 p.m. Eastern today. Oh, my God. I can't believe I'm doing this.
All right. We may take phone calls. I'm not sure. But at the very least, we'll take some IMs. See you in the fun house.
All right.
3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second.
The Majority Report.
Emma, welcome to the program.
Fun
Matt.
Who?
Fun.
What is up, everyone?
Fun.
Nomi Keen.
You did it.
Fun.
Let's go, Brandon.
Let's go, Brandon.
Fun. Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women.
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this 7-8?
Yes.
Is this me?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Oh,
think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm going to go start life.
Who libertarians?
They're so stupid, though.
Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge me.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-35-501. One half. 3-8.
9-11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less.
But let me say this.
Poop. You can call it satire. Sam goes, it's satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the wheat being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
Love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.